You're listening to BreadboxMedia.com. And I'm Chuck Coughlin.
And this is Setting the Record Straight. This program is called The Queen of the Vandals Falls in Love. Now, I don't want to disappoint you. It's not a romance, I'll tell you up front. Put your time boots on. Let's go back to the year 455 AD. You're in Rome. It's not a good day to arrive because the Vandals are sacking Rome, as they had already sacked other cities of the empire, burning the precious books, the irreplaceable manuscripts, the scientific articles that had, in duplicate copies, survived the fire at Alexandria. I'm referring to the legendary fire at the Library of Alexandria that burned it. That fire is really just a legend. It's even a common legend among anti-Catholics, and you can find it on references online elsewhere, that the Catholic Church burned the Library at Alexandria. Nothing could be farther from the truth. They preserved the Library at Alexandria. It was others that burnt it. The Library of Alexandria actually had a number of fires over the years. The worst was caused by Mark Antony, lover of Cleopatra. So if I disappointed you with my title referring to a romance, referring to falling in love, turn off this program if you want a romance and go back to Antony and Cleopatra. There's some good movies. There's a great play of Shakespeare's. This is a different kind of story, though some pretty erotic romances do play a small part in it. Actually, the Muslims did more to destroy the Library at Alexandria than anybody else. But they weren't entirely at fault either. So the sacking that the Vandals did of Rome in 455 does explain the loss of all those valuable documents in the secret archives of the Vatican that we're talking about on a series of programs that I base on a book that I discovered by Maria Luisa Ambrosini called The Secret Archives of the Vatican. Now, I've been talking about that a bit in a number of programs. The word secret here means the private archives, meaning the Pope's private archives. They're not secret. A scholar with credentials has always been able to access them for research. So in 455, Rome was sacked once again, this time by the Vandals. So here's another reason that before about 1300, there's only fragmentary remnants of the original archives of the Vatican. So we're standing here in 455. It's not a good place to be. You're going to get killed. The Vandals are here and killing everybody. Let's take off. Let's go into the future. Let's go 1,000 years into the future, over 1,000 years. Let's go up to 1600s. In the 1600s, the queen of the Vandals came to Rome, and not as a conqueror, but as a convert, a Catholic convert, in love with the church, as she had all her life been in love with learning. So the great loves of Christina Alexandra, queen of the Swedes, the Goths, and the Vandals, was actually the Catholic Church. Sorry to disappoint you. You can turn the program off now if you'd want to hear about this, but you might stick around a little while. She had a rather amazing life, sort of stupendous. As my British friends would say, you'll find you're not entirely unamused. So Christina Alexandra abdicated a throne that required adherence to the Lutheran faith. In those Lutheran eras, they were virulently anti-Catholic in the 1600s. We had just come through the Reformation, and it wasn't over with, really. She had to abdicate her throne. She had to choose between converting to Catholicism and continuing to be the excellent ruler that she was. And she loved her people. She was converted by two rather surprised missionaries who had expected no such results. She was the daughter of Gustavus Adolphus, and had become queen in 1632 when she was 6 years old, and had assumed control of the government at 18. She had been given the training of a crown prince. The rest of her education she had gotten for herself, from hours of study in the early morning and from minutes of study snatched from the duties of royalty. And she was a conscientious sovereign, concerned with trade and productiveness of her country. But with her gift for government, there were two other tendencies, her love of learning, and her stormy and wandering emotional life. It was in November of 1632 that her father, King Gustavus II Adolphus of Sweden, was killed in the Battle of Lützen. That was one of the most important battles of the Thirty Years' War. Thirty Years' War, often attributed to being a series of religious wars. Actually, the more you study, the more you realize that they were really political wars. There was a great deal of interweaving of religion and the state in these kingdoms. So it's difficult to unravel what the real cause of these wars were, really 100 years of war. It's usually attributed to religion by people who are agnostic or atheists. There are very few religious wars, contrary to common belief. I mean, the Civil War was not a war between the Baptists and the Presbyterians. The Second World War was not a war between the Hindus and the Buddhists. These were political wars, as are most of them. After King Gustavus died, the Swedes and the Lutherans rallied to defeat the forces of the Holy Roman Empire. After this Protestant victory, it was clear that Emperor Ferdinand could never restore the unity of Catholicdom, or even the unity of the Holy Roman Empire, for that matter. And of course, the Holy Roman Empire was not centered in Rome, and it was not, despite its name, really holy. So it was neither holy nor Roman, but it was an empire under Ferdinand. In winning the many victories prior to the Battle of Lützen, Gustavus Adolphus had struck a deadly blow at the heart of Catholicdom. One of the great ironies of history was that the only child of this Lutheran general and king, who waged war successfully against Catholics herself, was to become a convert to the Catholic Church. When Gustavus Adolphus was killed in battle, the male line of the Vasa dynasty of Sweden became extinct. His only child was 6-year-old Christiana, the heir to the throne. She's sometimes called Christina or sometimes called Christiana. Depends on the history you're reading. Well, she was born December 8th, 1626. They appointed a regent till she could take over at 18. The little girl was brought up as if she were a male, a prince, being trained in all aspects of ruling. Christiana was intelligent and curious. Her brilliant mind was constantly searching for intellectual fulfillment. She was brought up a Lutheran in a very intolerant country. 17 years before she was born, laws were passed decreeing exile and property confiscation for anybody that converted to the Catholic Church. Anyone teaching Catholic doctrine risked banishment as a traitor. Christiana did not share this hostility to Catholicism. Indeed, she was a rather tolerant person, even of Huguenots later in her life, when she journeyed to France. So when Christine was only 20, she faced down the council on the issue of religious intolerance, specifically a law forbidding Catholic foreigners to have Mass said even in their homes. But since her only understanding of Catholic doctrine had come from Lutheran preachers, she was at first not able to accept Catholicism either. So she devised a Christianity of her own and worshiped God according to what seemed best to her. She remained a firm believer in God, Christ, and especially the Bible, as many individualistic Protestants do. Their center of authority is the Bible. As the time came for Christianity to assume the full exercise of royal authority, the country asked one major question. Who would Christiana marry? She had received various proposals, but in her teenage years she was in love with her cousin, Charles Gustavus, and the two had become secretly engaged. There's a letter from Charles in 1644, when Christiana was 17. He swore his undying love. She advised him to keep their engagement a secret for a year or two, until she could be crowned, and then no one could prevent their marriage. Charles served in the army in Germany from 1642 to 45. When he returned to Sweden, he found Christiana, a reigning sovereign, no longer an infatuated young girl. She was preoccupied with her responsibilities and enthusiastic about ruling. Though he was still infatuated with her, she no longer loved him. In the meantime, her regent, Axel Oxenstierna, had put more power in the hands of the nobility at the expense of the crown. Christiana did not like this unbalanced situation and wanted to reassert the royal authority. but she could not really establish her position firmly until the question of the succession could be solved. A serious illness and an attempted assassination emphasized the importance of securing the succession to the throne. Everybody tried to push Christiana into marriage, but she had no intention of marrying except for love, and at this point she was not in love. Her plan for the succession was this: to make Charles Gustavus commander-in-chief of the armies, successor to the throne, and hereditary prince. She had to handle this plan carefully because the council would not like it, and neither would Charles. Charles guessed what she was doing and sent frantic letters to persuade her to marry him, all in vain. When he referred to himself as the most wretched man on earth, Christiana pointed out that he was going to succeed to the throne. She went ahead with her plan to appoint him commander-in-chief and sent him off to the army. He said, "I leave with a pain in my heart, which scarcely permits me to breathe." Christiana finally brought her plan out into the open. Of course, the council of noblemen were quite angry because they did not want Charles to be given royal honors. If he'd married Christiana, he would have no special privileges because all rights of succession would have descended upon the children. But if he were appointed hereditary prince and successor, he would receive authority over the nobility. So in the council, there was a terrific clash, and Christiana and the nobility were at an impasse. What happened next? Well, stick with me through the break and you'll find out. I'll continue this program about the Queen of the Vandals falling in love. This is BreadboxMedia.com. I'm Chuck Coughlin.
Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit BreadboxMedia.com.
You're listening to BreadboxMedia.com. And I'm Chuck Coughlin.
And this is Setting the Record Straight. Well, we're rejoined after the break. Today we're talking about the Queen of the Vandals falls in love. Queen Christiana of Sweden, of the Goths and the Vandals. Well, Queen Christiana had a terrible problem, this young queen. She didn't want to be forced into marrying, and the nobility were very concerned about the succession of the throne. Break the succession and there would be great instability and perhaps civil war. But Queen Christiana refused to marry except for love. But she came up with a plan the nobility didn't like at all. She had a cousin, Charles Gustavus, and the two young people, when they were teenagers, had fallen in love. Charles was still in love with her, but she was not in love with him anymore. But her plan for succession was to make her cousin Charles Gustavus commander-in-chief of the armies, successor to the throne, and most importantly, hereditary prince. She knew the council wasn't going to like it. They didn't. So let's see what happened. Christiana and the nobility held meetings, and there were many fiery arguments. She played clever politics by going to the estates, that's the assembly of the commoners, and getting them on her side. When the council saw that Christiana was starting to give some of their powers to the commoners, they were forced to go along with her plan. Finally, she was in firm control of the country. Charles, meanwhile, withdrew to his estates and sulked. Christiana's intellectual interests continued after she became queen. She was especially intrigued by philosophy, science, and mathematics. Enter a famous man and a great philosopher, stage right, who was the key to changing everything. The great philosopher, mathematician Descartes, René Descartes, came to Stockholm at her invitation. Two or three times a week they met at 5 a.m. She had little free time otherwise, to study together. Descartes died in Stockholm on February 11, 1650. But during the time he was working with Christiana, she had come to realize that Catholicism could be the true religion. She found that through Descartes, that nothing in the Catholic religion was contrary to reason, as her Lutheran teacher has taught her to believe. That this brilliant man, whom she so much admired, could also be a dedicated and convinced Catholic, persuaded her that Catholicism was the true religion. I think you know Descartes if you've ever studied arithmetic. Descartes' rule of signs, and the famous skeptical Descartes. Descartes was so skeptical that he wondered what he could really prove about anything. And he came up with this, his own existence. Cogito ergo sum. I think, therefore I am. He could prove that. Cartesian logic is named after Descartes. Well, he was a man of reason, a great skeptical reason, very famous for it. But he was a Catholic, and his example persuaded Christiana that Catholicism was indeed the true religion. In the summer of 1650, a new ambassador from Portugal arrived in Stockholm. His regular interpreter fell ill, and a substitute was found among his suite. It turned out that the substitute was the ambassador's chaplain, a Jesuit priest in disguise. Wow, a Jesuit priest in disguise. He had to be in disguise in this anti-Catholic land. Christiana soon realized the situation, and in the midst of diplomatic discussions with the ambassador, asked the interpreter questions about religion. The ambassador, not understanding Swedish, could not figure out why his interpreter took so long to translate what he said. The priest, his name was Father Machido, was finally given the mission by Christiana of carrying a letter to the Jesuit general in Rome, asking for two Jesuits to come secretly to Stockholm to instruct her in Catholic doctrine and to receive her into the church. Father Machido knew that he would not get permission from the ambassador, fearful of diplomatic repercussions to carry out his mission, so he had to flee in secret, in great secrecy. The mission was completed, and the two Jesuits, Francesco Malinas and Paolo Casati, came to Stockholm, disguised, yes, as laymen. They carried instructions in code, referring to Christiana as Signor Teofilo. When they arrived in Stockholm, Christiana was immediately curious at the presence of these two Italians in her city. She suspected they might be the Jesuits she had requested. At an opportune moment, she asked, "Have you a letter for me?" Without turning his head, Casati murmured, "Si, yes." The next day, she received them in private audience, and her instructions began. Demanding an intellectually satisfying religion, Christiana had many questions and insisted on rational explanations for each disputed point. You want to know what some of her questions were? Was there such a thing as providence? Was the human soul immortal? Was there any difference between good and evil? Or did everything just depend on effects? She hungrily absorbed all that the Jesuits had to tell her, and she began to realize that her conscience would permit her to do nothing else except become a Catholic. Having committed herself to the Catholic Church, she now faced a serious dilemma. The anti-Catholic laws in Sweden were fierce, and the government was intimately bound up with the Lutheran Church. Christiana could not see how she could remain as queen and still be faithful to her new religion. Therefore, she resolved to abdicate. This abdication would be a great sacrifice. Sweden was one of the strongest nations in Europe, and Christiana possessed every conceivable royal privilege. By abdicating, she would surrender her position and all guarantee of security for the rest of her life. She risked even more than material loss. If her secret conversion were revealed prematurely, a revolt might break out. Christiana could be imprisoned, even killed. So she formally abdicated in favor of Charles. The real reason for her abdication was her conversion. But that was a well-kept secret. The publicly announced reasons were that the abdication would be in the best interest of the country, of Charles and herself. She stated that her country would be in a stronger position in Europe with a male ruler, and Charles would no longer be in a position of uncertainty, and that she would have time to devote to the arts and sciences and other intellectual pursuits. There was much opposition, but no one could prevent her abdication. She left Stockholm and went to Halmstad. There she sent part of her suite home, including her Lutheran chaplain. Then she did something rather surprising. She had her hair cut and dressed in male clothes. Under the name of Count Donas, she went to Hamburg in Germany, then Antwerp. That was the Low Countries at that time ruled by Spain. In Antwerp, she wrote to Charles that she would never return to Sweden. She made this secret journey because she feared that she might be forcibly detained in Sweden to prevent her conversion. She had lived under great strain for 3 years, afraid that her conversion would be found out, and that she would therefore face all the heavy legal penalties. Even though she'd been the queen, she knew that anti-Catholic feeling in Sweden was so strong that it would not have exempted her from the full force of the penalties. Fearful that at the last minute she had been found out, she chose to escape disguised as a man, Count Donas. But now she was unfriendly soul. She formally but secretly embraced the Catholic faith, Christmas Eve, 1654. She still did not publicly reveal her conversion because she had to get her assets out of Sweden so that she would not be a pauper the rest of her life. So then she went to Innsbruck, Austria, the territory ruled by the men her father had defeated in the 30 Years' War. Then it was November 3, 1655. Before the high altar of the Innsbruck Royal Chapel, in the presence of Pope Alexander VII's personal representative, Christiana made her public profession of faith. The ceremony was moving and beautiful, with all the pageantry of the church and of royalty brought out to celebrate the occasion. As Christiana had known, she was immediately vilified by anti-Catholics. They said that her conversion was a whim, that no one as intelligent and educated as she could seriously embrace Catholicism. But Christiana did not care about criticism. She had found her true love. She had found her true spiritual home. She had fallen in love with the Catholic Church. Just before Christmas, she entered Rome, met by a royal reception. In her honor, Bernini, no less. Bernini redesigned the Porto del Popolo. That's a grand entrance into Rome, which exists today. The Porto is a great gate, an arch that you enter coming into the city. So this structure was redesigned in her honor, and to this day it bears the inscription welcoming her. She spent most of the rest of her life in Rome, occasionally involving herself in diplomatic negotiations with Spain and France. 32 years after her conversion, she finally died and was buried in St. Peter's Basilica, where a beautiful monument celebrates her conversion, honoring the queen who gave up an earthly throne for the kingdom of God. The queen of the Vandals had fallen in love with the Catholic Church. I know the feeling. We're going to break in a moment. In the first two segments of this program, I've really given you a broad brush, quick overview of Queen Christiana's life. But it's full of fascinating details. So after the break, I'm going to back up a bit, take a few steps back with our time boots, and we'll look at her life more closely. Some of it may be a bit shocking, some of it's just glorious. And you'll have a much better picture of the way things were then. The way things were. This is Setting the Record Straight. I'm Chuck Coffin on BreadboxMedia.com.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit BreadboxMedia.com.
This is BreadboxMedia.com. I'm pleased you're still listening. I'm still talking to you. We're reflecting on Queen Christiana Alexander of Sweden. Chuck Coughlin on Setting the Record Straight, talking about this glorious Catholic woman. There's quite a bit of information about her. Among the secret archives of the Vatican's documents is an unsigned description of her life and personality as a reigning queen. I'll quote from it. "The Queen of Sweden has a small body, a spacious forehead, and large, clear, friendly eyes. Her nose is aquiline and thin. She's nothing of a woman. Her voice, her way of talking, her walk, her gestures are fully virile. She rides like a hussar. Unless one sees her from nearby, he thinks that she's a man. When she rides, she wears a hat and coat as the Spanish do. And it is only from the long dress that one knows that she's a woman. She puts her horse to the gallop without her feet in the stirrups. No one could follow her. Her riding costume is so ordinary that it could not cost even 5 gold scudi. She wears ordinary clothes, even at court. She never wears jewelry, only one ring. Her shirt is often stained with ink from all the writing she does, and sometimes it's ragged. If one suggests that she ought to take better care of herself, she says that's for people who have nothing to do." Well, that's a pretty good description, isn't it? Queen Christiana was nothing if not a working queen. The description goes on. "Each morning she dedicates herself to public matters, and each day she attends the council. Even when for 16 days she had a very high temperature. Alone she received the ambassadors of the crowns. Alone she answers them. Generals who have terrified Germany by force of arms tremble before her. She has grown up such a woman that she's remained free in a free kingdom. She loves all nations, and in everyone she loves goodness and nothing else. She says there's only 2 kinds of men in the world, honest men and wicked men. She does not allow marriage to be mentioned. No one has been able to persuade her to marry. She says that she was born free and she wants to die free. She sometimes turns very quickly from smiles and laughter to royal dignity and majesty. She has a retinue of noble ladies in waiting, but more for form than for personal services. She talks very little with them. She prefers to talk with men. Queen Christiana knows 10 or 11 languages, even the Saracen of the Hebrews and the Arabs. She has read all the ancient poets and modern French and Italian writers. She studied the ancient philosophers. As for the ancient holy fathers, she has read Augustine, Tertullian, well, for the most part, but she does not like them very much. She greatly enjoys Lactantius, Clement of Alexandria, Ambrose, and especially Jerome and Cyprian. Her memory is more than human. She has called to Sweden very learned men, artists and scientists from Italy, from Germany, from France. Comenius has been called in to reform Swedish education. Pascal had presented her with a computer, and the mechanistic Descartes had failed to persuade her that living and non-living things were alike, or to kill in her that reverence for life that is the latest and least recognized of the virtues. And Grotius, father of international law, was a scholar in residence. The slogan makers of the time called her capital city the Athens of the North. She worshipped the arts with the humble reverence that one sometimes sees in men and women of action. In her wooden capital on a frozen coast, she collected art treasures from the Italian Renaissance, ancient manuscripts from the early centuries of Catholicdom. Though she had an advantage that many collectors would envy, conquering armies to bring home the libraries and art objects she wanted. It's true that her personal life was such that Europe speculated on the number, sex, and degrees of relationship of her lovers. There seems to be no doubt that Christiana was a biological variant. The only question is to the extent of her variation and whether there were 1 or 2 divergent tendencies at work. There was a princess, Lucienne Murat, who gave this account of Christiana's birth. "The infant presented itself with its little bottom in the air, black as a marmot, and so covered with hair that it would frighten you." A marmot is a type of little monkey. "It cried, my faith, it cried, with a voice so strong that the wise women of Stockholm, doubtless trusting their ears, ran happily to tell Gustavus Adolphus that the queen had given birth to a boy. Premature eagerness, a hurried glance, boy or girl. Well, the matter was contestable, the sex capricious. No doubt these ladies, a little short-sighted, should have put on their eyeglasses. But this little marmot grew into a child that was strong, intelligent, and loved for her own qualities, as well as for her rank." You know, the Secret Archives has a copy of a letter signed with the name of the Jesuit, Father Malinas, who assisted the Queen in her conversion. Although Vatican experts have some doubt of its validity, in any case, it sets forth the official explanation. Here's what it says. The very serene Queen Christiana of Sweden has for some years found certain dissonances in the Lutheran sect in which she has been reared, and she determined to make every study to ascertain the true faith. She wanted to evaluate the substance and foundations of every religion and sect, and not satisfied with that, she desired and created an opportunity to discuss this matter with men who were in that part of the world, to make acquaintance of the most celebrated, and to invite them with great rewards to her court, under the pretext of acquiring their knowledge, but actually in order to investigate their beliefs. She began to discover the truth of the Catholic faith, and wanted to have members of the religious who could fully instruct her. So as we said earlier in the program, the vicar of the Jesuits received a request for her and secretly sent his two Jesuit missionaries to Sweden. One of them reported back. As soon as we arrived in Stockholm, we were admitted to the Queen's presence. In public, we were gentlemen travelers. In secret, we were religious. We were amazed to find in a princess of 25 years a soul so disillusioned with the vanity of human greatness. Not long afterward, she clearly stated that she definitely planned to embrace the Catholic faith and to renounce for it the kingdom in which she was not only respected, but worshipped, and had an authority stronger and more absolute than her own father ever had. So that's what it said. Arrangements for the abdication and the Queen's final decision took quite a while, but finally she did make it on Christmas Eve, 1654. She made her profession of faith. It's been suggested that she rejected Lutheranism because it preached predestination, that only the free will of the church could satisfy so imperious a queen. She was strongly attracted toward Roman cultural life. For her, exile would in a sense be homecoming. Or so she may have felt it necessary, as most of us do not, to keep a vow made in illness. Certainly her health had been poor, and the warmth of Italy offered a promise of recovery. And there was probably a deeper instinctive drive toward the south, to the lands she had seen in technicolor, on the great paintings she collected. There is an atavistic pull in the directions of Africa. Man became man in the warm countries. There were no icy Edens. When Maria Luisa Ambrosini writes about this in her book, The Secret Archives of the Vatican, she says this: I think her conversion was real, and that it was brought about by her reading of the patristic philosophers. Neither the Jesuit missionaries, so dazzled by the throne, could have reached such a woman. But the patristic writers were men of her own quality, men like Clement of Alexandria, Ambrose, Jerome, Cyprian. When Christiana's act of abdication was signed, it received 300 crimson seals fixed to it. She made her abdication speech in the white dress of a convert, but she had left Sweden disguised as a man, incognito. Pope Alexander VII thought it best to have her make a public conversion before coming to Italy, or at least before she entered the Papal States. To arrange this, and perhaps to keep the queen in line, he quietly dispatched Monsignor Lucas Holstinius to join her traveling party. The Pope may have chosen his emissary carefully. Holstinius was like Christiana, a convert from the Lutheran faith, and he was the chief librarian of the Vatican and a deeply learned man. There's a document in the Archives Miscellany. It's entitled this: Report on the Journey and Reception Made by His Holiness Alexander VII in the Ecclesiastical States and in Rome to Her Majesty Christiana Alexandra, Queen of Sweden. It goes on: Our Lord appointed 4 nuncios to meet her at the borders of the papal territory. He ordered that one of the most noble carriages, 2 very sumptuous beds, and 2 canopies and stools to match it, and a precious credenza, all of gold and silver, with the necessary services. He ordered all that be there, so that the queen might know not only his affection, but also his pontifical magnificence. When she entered into the papal states, she was escorted by 3 companies of horsemen. All her journey was a triumph. Salvos of cannon welcomed her in Ferrara. In Forli, the square had been made into a forest with poles of wood adorned with leaves and flowers. In Assisi, she attended the church of St. Francis. And Spoleto, Poems were sung in her honor. At Terni, she was a guest in the bishop's palace. Perfumes eddied through the rooms. In the evening, to provide her with spiritual entertainment, there was an oratorio in the Roman style. And at Bracciano, the lake north of Rome, it was described that very virtuous musicians, with their sweet voices, proved that Rome was heaven on earth, not guarded by an angel with a burning sword, but in the care of God's vicar. A cavalcade from the Pope came to meet her at Bracciano, as another cavalcade had come to that same place to meet Charlemagne. Here's the description. First came two pages dressed in red, then the trumpeters, followed by an army with shields, then a great number of noblemen, Italian and German, the cardinals, and the Roman nobility. Then came the cardinal's carriages, each drawn by six horses, too few for the weight of the treasures with which they were decorated. That's the description. And this was regarded as an informal affair, and the cavalcade, after the meeting with the queen, took her incognito to a roadside meeting with the Pope. Today's Catholics might find all this magnificence a little uncomfortable, but you have to understand at times. It was an essential part of the language of diplomacy of that time. We'll break now. This is Chuck Coughlin on BedboxMedia.com.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit BreadboxMedia.com.
You're listening to BreadboxMedia.com.
Just before the break, we're talking about the magnificent royal reception that was given to Queen Christiana of Sweden, the queen of the Vandals and Goths, who had converted to Catholicism and had come to Rome as a refuge because she would scarcely survive at all in her native land, where she had abdicated her throne in order to convert to Catholicism. So no wonder she had a fine reception. But guess what? This wasn't her formal entrance into Rome. The Pope sent her a carriage chair and a litter, described as all of light blue velvet with splendid silver decorations and interiors quilted with silver. The stirrups were of heavy silver. The queen, in gold embroidered riding breeches and a plumed hat, was surrounded by cardinals as she went to the Te Deum at St. Peter's. Now, Pope Alexander VII was as new to the papacy as Christiana was to Catholicism, but he had had a distinguished career in church diplomacy. One of his cardinals described him a few years later, thusly, "The Pope demands an exquisite refinement at all things, especially things that have to do with food and clothing. He likes vestments, with all the ornaments that can make him more handsome. When he goes to the country, he wears decorations with little diamond buttons. At the reception of the Queen of Sweden, he omitted nothing to make it illustrious and equal to the triumphs of the Romans. And he himself, with his magnificent face, made all things vibrate." There were fireworks, pyrotechnic displays in the evening, with the queen's coat of arms and that of the Pope blazing together as if for a royal marriage. It may have meant less to her than her visit to the Vatican Library. I suspect so. And her stay in the guest apartment in the Tower of the Winds, with its stormy paintings and its astronomical devices. The Tower of the Winds was sort of a Vatican observatory in a way. I'm going to come back to that subject. It's so interesting. And the beautiful poetic name, the Tower of the Winds. Well, Christina had come to a Rome that was 100 years. That was 100 years into the Counter-Reformation. The 30 Years' War was recently over. Galileo was a dozen years dead. And the church was finding relief from unhappy solutions by returning to music and to building. Michelangelo's plan of functional porticos, which would have been designed to keep horses and carriages out of the rain, was being elaborated into the triple aisle magnificence of the Bernini colonnades. Alexander VII was carrying on an urban renewal program. Squares were being opened up and new streets cut through houses and palaces. To an immigrant from the North, Rome of the mid-17th century must have seemed a busy growing center of civilization. But Queen Christiana had difficulty adapting to her new life. And Alexander and his successors as popes needed all their training in diplomacy to get along with her. Not even the spiritual battle plans of the Jesuits contain adequate instructions on how to deal with a queen like this. By terms of her abdication, she was to retain the rank of queen, and revenues were provided for support. As always, she spent too much, particularly on books, art objects, and gifts. The real difficulty, of course, was that she had no work to do. By genetic makeup and training, she was one of Plato's guardians of the city. And now she had no city to guard. The queen's physical makeup is a fascinating medical mystery to modern people. There's no doubt that she was physically and emotionally attracted to both men and women. Whatever the condition, one has the impression of an increasing feminization as time went on. From infancy to the grave, Queen Christiana's life truth was the love of learning. It had been with her in the cold palaces at Stockholm and in the guest apartment at the Tower of the Winds, and it cared nothing for the sex of the hormones that gave it vitality. Nevertheless, some of the queen's unused energy went into rebellion, not against the Catholic Church, but certainly against some of its representatives. The popes had an uneasy time with her. The child who had lost her father too early found a new father to torment and tease. When you go through the archives, you can find traces of the queen's stubbornness. One is a reference to a note of the pope's confessors, in which he states that the pope has forgiven Christiana, quote, for what happened, but that he intends to punish the criminals. You could make two columns on a piece of paper. On the left, you could make a short list. It would be the list of her flaws. On the right, there would be a long list, the list of her virtues. And put in the right-hand column are the facts that she worked for the cause of peace in a time when the church had almost forgotten it. And that in the Rome of the Inquisition, she spoke for the rights of heretics. The early Catholics had been pacifists, and so had Augustine until the Vandals got too close. And after that, Augustine decided fighting, while wrong for priests, was permissible for other ranks. Later, the popes, accepting this distinction, had wholeheartedly embraced going to war as an instrument of ecclesiastical policy. They would have been wiped out of existence had they not. Yet this woman, whose great regret was that she had never been in combat, harried her ambassadors into ending the 30 Years' War by the Treaty of Westphalia. With subtle tact, she urges mercy toward the enemies on the King of Poland when she writes to congratulate him on the liberation of Vienna. Quote, I no longer possess any kingdom, and I have the independence and quiet that I value more than all the kingdoms in the world. I thought I could never envy anyone, but your majesty has proved to me that I am capable of it. I envy you the beautiful title of liberator of Catholicism and the pleasure of giving life and liberty to the many unhappy persons among your friends and enemies. Well, Christiana loved all peoples, including heretics. By the time of the revocation of the Edict of Nantes, which had given protection to the French Huguenots, she wrote to Abbot Talbot on the extirpation of heresy in France. Quote, I'm not convinced of the success of this great design. I cannot rejoice over this policy as I could over things that would be favorable to our religion. Are you truly convinced of the sincerity of all these new converts? I would not want to have on my conscience all the sacrileges that those forced into Catholicism will commit. Men of war prefer to kill, to rape, to loot, rather than to persuade. I weep for those who were born to error, but it seems to me that they deserve pity rather than hate. France today is a sick person whose arms and legs are being amputated to heal her of an illness that with some patience and kindness could have been entirely cured. Jesus Christ did not use such methods to convert the world. So in many ways, she was a woman of the 21st century, trapped in the 17th century. There are numerous letters dealing with the last period of her life and with her death. 1689, she died. There are clinical accounts of her illness and of the treatments attempted. even the most humiliating ones, and speculations on her will. There are records of plans to get noble children accepted as pages, to share in the queen's generosity toward her household. Christina accepted her progressive illness with stoicism and good humor. "I have 8 devils, 4 doctors, and 4 blood letters." The daily reports gave a dramatic account of her illness. Quote, our queen is better. Her eyes are very lively, as they normally are. She has joked. The queen is out of danger. The viceroy of Naples wants to send 3 doctors rushing to her. The Pope wants to have a doctor come from Bologna. The ambassadors of France, the ambassadors of England, come to offer their services. The couriers rush back and forth. The queen is at Notunno. The cardinals come to her very often to see her. A new attack of breathlessness. Our queen has lost her speech. Our queen has been believed dead. The queen has been given an enema, after which she went to the toilet. She felt better, and she was able to eat with pleasure. All Rome has been concerned. On Tuesday we wept for our queen, but now we believe she's out of danger. The queen has entrusted her will to the notary Bailey. A report on the illness, death, and funeral of Her Royal Majesty Christiana Alexandra, Queen of Sweden, is in the archives, miscellanea. I'll read from it. In the morning of April 19th, as if she had had a long rest, lying on her right side without moving, without contortion, better to say, with an unusual calm, she went to enjoy heaven. Unquote. She had asked to be buried in a simple funeral at the church of the Rotunda, but the Pope, to honor this princess who had brought so much honor to the Holy Church, ordered that she be buried with great pomp in the Vatican Basilica of St. Peter. Only 6 noblewomen and only 1 other queen were buried there. Christiana was to be in the company of men, which she had always preferred. Her body, embalmed according to custom, was exposed in her palace from Tuesday until Friday night under a canopy, dressed in white embroidered with gold, continuously attended by barefoot Carmelite friars. And from Rome and the villages near, the common people came, bringing narcissus and other spring flowers, gathered in the nearby hills. Her funeral was as elaborate as her entrance into Rome. Over her white dress was the royal mantle of purple, embroidered with golden crowns and with a wide border of ermine. On her head was the royal crown, and in her hand the scepter. The archives does contain several copies of her testament. She thanked God for having called her to the true faith and humbly asked for mercy for our endless sins. Most of the library and the rich collection of manuscripts she had left to Cardinal Azzolini, so those are in the Vatican archives. She was buried with the mantle, the crown, and the scepter. But this variant was like everyone else at last, and the Queen of the Vandals had made atonement for the sins of her people. This is BreadboxMedia.com. I'm Chuck Hoff.